want to thank, there's an anonymous sponsor for tonight's shir, Le'ili Nishmas, Ryan Avram Kaldar, whose shloshim was, I think, last night or this night, tonight, I think it was last night. So the shir is dedicated to Le'ili Nishmas, Avraham ben Moshe HaKohen, Zichrono Levracha. The second day of Hanukkah, 1922, in a small base medrash somewhere in Yerushalayim, Rav Kook, the chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael at the time, before the state, and his chavrusa Rav Yitzhak Arieli were sitting and learning together in their base medrash. And lo and behold, while they're learning, who walks in? None other than Eliezer ben Yehuda, the father of modern Hebrew, known to be not only a non-religious person, but a vehemently anti-religious person. He walks into the study of the chief rabbi on that second day of Hanukkah morning. And he has a whole laundry list of questions for the chief rabbi to figure out etymologies, philologies of different words in Hebrew that he's trying to figure out to decipher. And who besides the chief rabbi would be able to figure out all the different Hebrew words from the rabbi's knowledge of Chachmas HaNigla, HaNistar. And Rav Kook, one by one, answers all the questions and figures out the etymologies of this word and this word and this word, helping Ben Yehuda in his task in compiling his dictionary of the modern Hebrew language. And then finally, the questions are over, and there's an awkward silence, and Rav Kook opens his mouth and says, "Mr. Ben Yehuda, do you think maybe the time has come for you to do tshuva?" There's a moment of pause, and Ben Yehuda responds, "Perhaps," walks out. That evening, on the third day, the third night of Hanukkah, Ben Yehuda dies in 1922. That chavrusa was learning with Rav Kook pointed out that he wonders that perhaps that word perhaps of Ben Yehuda was a hirhur tshuva, a contemplation of a moment of tshuva. Because the Gemara in Kedushin teaches the following halacha that we've mentioned once before, at least once, if not twice. If a person wants to enter some kind of agreement or relationship with a condition, he's entitled or she's entitled to instill a stipulation or condition into that relationship, into that agreement. And therefore, if a man were to approach a woman and give her a ring and say, "Hareat mikudesh asli, I'm going to marry you, al menas she'ani ashi, on the condition that I am a fabulously wealthy person," well, are they married or not? Very simple. If he's fabulously wealthy, they're married. And if he's not fabulously wealthy, they're not married. You could do that. And then the Gemara continues. And it says, if a person gives a woman a ring and says, "Hareat mikudesh asli, you're married to me, al menas she'ani tzadik gomer, on the condition that I am absolute righteous tzadik," then are they married or not? Says the Gemara, every single person might have a halacha of being married. We have to assume that every single person will have been married, and we have to be concerned that they might be married. Why? Shema hir her tshuva belibo. Maybe that person, right before they uttered it, even a person who's a rasha gomer, a person who's entirely evil, maybe they had a hir her tshuva, fleeting contemplation of tshuva the moment before. And therefore we have to be worried that there is a kedushin. And that's what Rav Kook's chavrusa said, that maybe that perhaps of Ben Yehuda was that hir her tshuva that came just in time. This concept of a hir her tshuva, fleeting thought of tshuva, and the power that it brings with it, could shed light on a very simple question that you probably never asked, although it could be asked. We make brachas when we do mitzvahs. We blew shofar a few last week, we said Asher Kedushanu, and then before Kriyas HaMegillah, and before Lulav next week, we say Asher Kedushanu whenever we do a mitzvah. Before I put on my tefillin, I say Asher Kedushanu. How come we don't say a Birchas HaMitzvah on the mitzvah of teshuva? And if you say there's no specific time that you have to do teshuva, teshuva is just out there and available for you when you want to. If you do it, it's great. If you don't do it, okay, so you just didn't do teshuva. That's true much of the year, but on Yom Kippur, there's an absolute mitzvah chiyuvis to do teshuva. You must do teshuva on Yom Kippur. Even if you chose not to do it last week and next, on Yom Kippur, there's a chiyuv to do teshuva. So at least on Yom Kippur, where is the Asher Kedushanu says, "Tzivanu al mitzvahs tshuva"? or la'asas tshuva, or lashuv, whatever terminology you want to use. So I'll share with you a few answers. The third is the one that I want to focus on. One answer that's offered is the following. Let's say I steal your iPhone. Well, there's a mitzvah d'oraisa. V'heshev es hagzela asher gazal. I have to mitzvah to return your iPhone to you. Before I return that iPhone, do I make a bracha? Asher k'deshan v'mitzvah v'tzvanu l'hachzir es ha'iPhone or al hashavas gzela to return what I stole? No, absolutely not. Why not? Because you shouldn't have stolen in the first place. You shouldn't be in the first place. Forget about returning it. You shouldn't have. So too is tshuva. If you wouldn't have done whatever you did in the first place, you wouldn't have to do tshuva. Therefore, it does not warrant a bracha. Along similar but a little bit different lines, also a fascinating approach, the Rashba in his Shas Tshuva says the following. There's a mitzvah, believe it or not, it's a mitzvah, on Beis Din to execute those who need to be executed. If for whatever reason somebody is liable for capital punishment, the mitzvah has there's a Beis Din has a mitzvah to do it. Do they say Asher Kedushan Mitzvotav Mitzvano Al Mitzvah Skila Sreifa Herek Chenek? Do they have to say Asher Kedushan? Of course not. Why not? Well, the Rashba says same idea, pretty much the same idea. Hashem doesn't want this guy to die. It's not what he wants. Okay, it has to be done. That's not what Hashem wants, and therefore, tshuva is not what Hashem's really looking for. He would love that there doesn't have to be tshuva. But the third answer, this is what I want to focus on. Let's think for a minute back a few months. Back to Pesach. Erev Pesach. We're getting rid of our chametz. What do? How do we get rid of our chametz? There's bedikas chametz, beer, which is the end of the bedika, and we have to do bittul chametz. It's a chiyuv to do bittul chametz. Everybody's obligated to do bittul chametz. Either d'oraisa or d'rabban, you have to do bittul chametz. What bracha do we say nevertheless? Asher k'deshavim b'tzatzav b'tzivano al? Only on bedikas chametz or bir chametz. Not on the bittul. Why not? Well, because any mitzvah that you do in your heart, you don't have to, you don't get, say a bracha on that. And therefore, bittul chametz is a mitzvah b'lev, you're not going to say a bracha. And tshuva also, you could do with this, as we just mentioned, this fleeting thought, this shem hir her tshuva b'libo, and therefore, if a fleeting thought can comprise tshuva, it doesn't warrant a bracha. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a very simple question that you're all wondering. How do you do tshuva? How do you do tshuva? So I wanted to convey a certain point to my students. So I had them stand up. It's always awkward when you ask a college student to stand up in class in front of his friends. I always pick the coolest guy so he could feel the most awkward in this way. It's always good for... So I pick the coolest guy in the class. I say, please stand up. I want you to do tshuva. And I'm going to time you. The second coolest guy, say, take out your stopwatch, take out your phone, turn on your stopwatch, your timer, and I want to time you how long it's going to take to do tshuva. So first we outline what tshuva is. You have to do vidui, a verbal admission, then you have to do have charata, and then, of course, accepting on the future, kabbalah al ha'asid. And he says, okay, I pick something innocuous, like lashon hara. We're not going to get anything too, you know, embarrassing, so we'll start with lashon hara. We all did a little lashon hara. So he gets up and shir, and the first guy says, okay, I said lashon hara about so-and-so, and it hurt his feelings. It probably hurt me in a certain sense. I feel bad. 27 seconds. I say, sit down. I want much, much faster than that. Okay, so now I pick the third coolest guy in the shir. So he gets up, and he says, 14 seconds timed on the stopwatch. He did his tshuva, his three parts of tshuva. But wait a second. It still takes 14 seconds. He has to say vidui. He has to express or at least feel his charat, his remorse. And he has to say or commit himself to not do it again. That, right, the sentence that I just said took about 14 seconds. So how could we say that tshuva happens in the heart? How could we say that tshuva is a mitzvah just like bittul chametz? It just happens, shemihir her tshuva belibo, the perhaps of a ben Yehuda. The answer is so important. You know, before Rosh Hashanah, Chazal were metaken that we must lay in Parashas Nitzavim. We must lay in Parashas Nitzavim on the Shabbos immediately or second to the penultimate Shabbos of the year. Why is that? Because it has the Parashah of Tshuva there. And in the Parashah of Tshuva, I'm going to read a few words to you. And I want to see if you could pick out something unusual, or maybe repetitive. See how you do. V'hashivosa el vavecha. V'shavta ad Hashem alkecha b'chol levavcha. V'mal Hashem alkecha es levavcha v'es levav zarecha. B'chol levavcha v'chol nafshecha. Ki sashiv el Hashem, you return to Hashem b'chol levavcha. Ki kov elecha davar ma'ol b'fichol v'levavcha la'aso. So seven psukim out of 14 that list the word what? Lev. What's the problem? Tshuva is not just belev. Tshuva has to have a verbal component. Tshuva has to have a commitment in terms of our activities and how we carry ourselves. Why the focus on lev? In fact, if you look in the Rambam does not count tshuva as a mitzvah, but he counts vidui, which is the first step of tshuva, as the mitzvah d'oraisa, vidui, which is the verbal, not belev. The point is so simple. The point is, you're right, for a full tshuva you need three steps. For really full tshuva we'll talk about later. But it all starts with a lev. Because you know what happens with a lev? The lev has a very powerful strength. I'll tell you what the lev could do. There's an incredible ravid. And let me tell you what this ravid says, because it shatters our perception of how we're judged on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Because we're familiar with the Rambam. The Rambam says that when it comes time to be judged, there's that scale. My two-year-old came home from Broyles last week with a scale, okay, made out of paper. Mitzvos on one side, averis on the other side, and the goal is that all the mitzvah notes that we write to her mora get stapled on the side of mitzvos, right? We don't send in avera notes. We don't do that. A number of you are probably psychologists, Rebecca. A number of us are psychologists, so we know we don't send in avera notes. It's not good for anybody. Might be lashon hara also, other things. So we send in mitzvah notes. So lo and behold, you have your mitzvah notes weighing down, and that's the scale. That's how Gila came home from school on Erev Rosh Hashanah. That's the Rambam. The Ravid says that's not how we're judged. It doesn't work like that. You know how it works? Says the Ravid, the judgment is not quantitative, but it's qualitative. It's, is this person in the, not where is the person, but is the person in the direction that they're supposed to be? Is the trajectory in the right direction? If the person is a growing person in the right direction, that's who we call a tzaddik. If a person is in the direction of doing more averus, I don't care what number they're at right now, if it's in the direction of doing more averus, then they're a rasha. And that's how we're judged, says the Ravid. And if that's the case, we could have an unbelievable perspective that you could do tshuva with a tiny change of heart and nothing else, because that changes our directions. Not where we are. In a moment, we can't change the coordinates of our spiritual location, but we could change the direction of our spiritual trajectory. That's the first thought that I'd like to share with you as an introduction. For tonight, I'd like to really talk about just two points, two separate points, not necessarily connected one to another, and then finish off this evening with two practical applications in our own practical tshuva. Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Shehachanu Israel. This past Shabbos was Shabbos Shuva, and the reason why I didn't get a Shabbos Shuva drasha is because none of you were here. So we give a Wednesday night Shuva drasha. The difference is it's not a Shabbos Shuva drasha; it's a Shabbos Shuva drasha. This is a Shuva drasha with a tough in the beginning, because Shabbos Shuva, the Haftorah starts Shuva Yisrael, Ad Hashem Elokecha. Why? Why do you have to do Shuva? What does your Shuva accomplish? Ki chashalta ba'avonecha. You stumbled over your averos. You tripped over them. When you do averos, do you trip over your averos? No, you walk right into them on purpose. That's why they're averos. Avonecha. Ki chashalta ba'avonecha. Avon is something that you did on purpose. It's not something that you stumbled over. Because of this problem, the Gemara tells us that when a person does tshuva, it changes The tshuva that they do metamorphoses the averus that they do, the willful sins that they did, into shogegs, into things that were just a stumbling, into things that were just a tripping, into something that they did not on purpose. That's the koach of tshuva. And, as you might remember, those of you who were here a year or two ago, there's another pasuk that says that when you do tshuva, Hashem changes the averus that we've done to, not to shogegs, not to things that we did by mistake, but to actual mitzvos. I did something wrong, I do tshuva on it, and that thing that I did wrong now becomes a mitzvah. If you just imagine all the lashon hara that we did, I sit down and I do tshuva, all of a sudden it turns into all those things become mitzvos. But wait a second, there's this contradiction. The Gemara says, no, there's no contradiction. Yes, there's a pasuk that says tshuva changes your mitzvah, your averus to a mitzvah. Another pasuk says it changes it to a mistake that you did unwillingly, but it's not a mitzvah. Tshuva Gemara says, kan me ava, kan me yira. Depends on how you did tshuva, what your motivation for tshuva was, what was the impetus, what pushed you. If you were motivated to do tshuva out of yira, schar, onesh. Onesh in this world, onesh in the next world, not important. But if your motivation was yira, then it changes whatever you did to shogeg. If our motivation to do tshuva is out of ahavas Hashem, then whatever averus we did is transmutated, is transformed to actually being a mitzvah. Very simple question now. I want to ask you a very simple question. Who's better off? The guy, the girl, who works hard and does mitzvahs? Or the guy and girl who lives a free life without any restrictions, holding nothing back, doing as they please, and doing lots and lots of averas? Who ends up in the end, if they do tshuva in the end at least, who ends up better? It's better off if you did averas. Because now when you do tshuva, not only will all your mitzvahs, but now all your averas turn into mitzvahs also. And you get the mitzvah of tshuva. It ends up being chote niskar. By virtue of you being chote, you end up in a better place than somebody who wouldn't have done those averas. That's the question that all the mefarshim ask. How could it possibly be that because you did averas, transformed into mitzvahs, and you end off being better off than if you would just have done mitzvahs your whole life? It's a very strong question. I'll tell you one answer, which I don't like. I assume you won't like it either. And then I'll try to share with you an explanation that I do like, and I hope you'll also like it better. The Maharsha asks this question. He says, how could it be? Hadava tamua, this is a wondrous, this is crazy. Nimtza seems to be that chote is niska. Somebody who does something wrong ends up profiting. Right? Cheaters never prosper. No, cheaters do prosper. They prosper more than everybody else. Says the Maharsha the following. When you do tshuva me'ava, that means you're coming with the whole package. It means you're coming in with a big 18-wheeler truck. Your tshuva is going to break through. And if you do tshuva me'ava, such a strong tshuva, it's not just going to be you're doing a little tshuva like this on that point. You're doing it full-fledged, full-heartedly. And therefore, of course, you're going to end up doing lots of mitzvahs in the wake of doing that tshuva. So it ends up you have more mitzvahs than the averus that you had originally. You had one aver and you do tshuva on it, but this tshuva is so powerful, it has a ripple effect that you end up doing a lot of mitzvahs. That's what it means, that when you do tshuva me'ava, it changes your averus into mitzvahs. I don't know. That's not satisfactory to me. Because he's saying, it doesn't really change your averus into mitzvahs, it just, you're doing more mitzvahs than you would have done otherwise because of your tshuva me'ava. That's not so great. There's a Hasidic sefer, the Arvei Nachal. Very early Hasidic sefer in the late 1700s. Actually, the end of his life, he moved from Poland, made Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael, moved to Tzfat. And he asks the question that we're asking in a striking, striking, striking way. Imagine the following. Were any of you ever at Versailles? Who here was at Versailles? You don't have to spell it for me. Just raise your hand if you were in France and Palace of Versailles. Really? Okay. Okay, okay. Fine. So you go into the Palace of Versailles and World War I, World War II. Treaties were signed in the Hall of Mirrors. World War I, I think. In the Hall of Mirrors. And it's a room that's just like the longest room you've ever seen. It's like 7,000 feet long. Not really. It's really, really, really long. One side is a sheet of windows overlooking the gardens of Versailles. And opposite is one long wall of mirrors. Hence, it's called the Hall of Mirrors. Very good. So in this Hall of Mirrors, King somebody or other, which king? Marina? One of the French kings. Louis, of course, it's always a Louis. Louis XIV, thank you. So Louis XIV is sitting in his bedchamber right outside the Hall of Mirrors, and he hears a loud bang, and another bang, and a shattering, and a shattering, and a shattering. He comes out and he sees that I walked in with a baseball bat to his Hall of Mirrors. And I'm going around bashing all the windows on one side and the mirrors on the other side of the Hall of Mirrors. And I see him, and in his majesty and the reverence that I have to him, I break down in tears, and I start crying. And I say, Your Majesty, I did the wrong thing. I'm sorry I was wrong. You're so great. You're so powerful. You're so benevolent to us. You're so beneficent. You're so magnanimous. You're so wonderful to us. I'm sorry for what I did. Tshuva me'ava. And after that, you submit him a bill for the hour that you spent breaking the windows. That, asks the Arvei Nachal, is exactly what we're doing when we do Averus, and then come to Hashem and say, okay, now I want the Averus that I did to be paid for. You have to give me reward for those Averus that I did. The imagery is striking. And if we just flesh out the same idea, let's say you have a spectrum. Over here you have mitzvahs, over here you have Averus. When you change something in Averus, I'm sorry, when you change an Avera into not being an Avera, where does it turn into? It doesn't go there, no. It turns to the middle. It becomes, I don't know, Rishus, something that's part of. If you have meat and you put it into the transformation machine, are you going to come out with milk? No, you'll come out with something that's part of. You'll come out with like an applesauce or something. You're not going to come out with milk. How could it be that when we do an Avera, and then we do Tshuva, that turns into, yes, with my Tshuva Me'ava, great, it was Me'ava, what does the Ava do anyway? That's going to transform what I did to be the exact opposite. Is there anything more diametrically opposed in the world, in all of the universe's existence, is there anything more diametrically opposed than a Mitzvah on one hand and an Avera on the other hand? These are the questions that the Arvei Nachal asks. And he gives an incredibly beautiful and deep answer. The answer that he gives is the following. He says that whenever a person does, and bear with me because it's a very nuanced point, whenever a person does an Avera, there's the Avera and there's the thought that's associated with doing that Avera. The Gemara in Kiddushin tells us that a Jew, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is not mitzaref machshava ra'a l'maisa. That means Hashem does not consider the negative thought that they had when they did an Avera. They're not punished for that thought per se, Jews. In the opposite, we are rewarded for our positive thoughts, but for our negative thoughts of that are accompanying doing an Avera, we are only punished for the Avera, not for the thought. That's what the Gemara tells us. And therefore, if I'm doing Tshuva Meyira, listen carefully. If I'm doing Tshuva Meyira, that means I'm doing Tshuva because I'm going to be punished, or rewarded, punished, whatever it is. So what am I in fact doing tshuva for? For the action that I did wrong. But I'm not doing tshuva for the thought. Why not? Because the thought is not punishable. Hashem doesn't punish Jews for the thoughts that accompany their negative actions. I'm not punished for the negative thoughts, and I'm not going to be doing tshuva if I'm doing tshuva meira. However, this is almost the punchline. Let's imagine the following scenario. I walk into the Hall of Mirrors, and I don't have a baseball hat in my hand. I'm wearing a suit. And I walk in a dignified manner. And I request in the most polite, most eloquent French, Parle français, may I please speak to the king? And they bring me to his room. And I say, Your Honor, the king. And then I sneeze. I sneezed in the presence of Louis XIV. And then I break down crying. I beg mercy. I climb down to the floor and hang on to his feet, pleading for mercy. I sneezed in your presence, Your Honor, Your Majesty, His Highness. I sneezed in your presence. you don't really have to apologize, you just sneezed. Well, if you do apologize so profusely, because of your great love for the Majesty Louis XIV, well, you were never going to be punished in the first place for sneezing. So what does your apologies accomplish? Your apologies showed something very special to the king. It shows how incredibly careful you are about who he is, about his honor, about his the preciousness of the king in your eyes. Now listen carefully. This is the punchline. When we do tshuva me'ahava, the tshuva me'ahava that I have, the regret that I have for having done something wrong, I feel bad not just for the actions that I do, but for how can I even think about having done something to blaspheme HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Malach Malachim Lachim HaKadosh Baruch Hu is so incredible, so wonderful. How can I even think of, how can I ponder of doing something to negate his omnipotence, his omniscience, his all, everything, his wonderfulness, his good, his greatness, his kindness? That's tshuva me'ahava. And when I do that, I'm doing tshuva both on the action and on the thoughts that I had to do averos. But wait a second. You were never going to be punished on those thoughts in the first place. Just like the guy who sneezed, he's never going to be punished on his sneeze. So what are you doing tshuva for? It's not canceling. Okay, the tshuva will cancel out the avero that you did. But here, you're doing tshuva not just on the sneeze, but on the me'ava. You're doing something for, no, I'm sorry, not just for breaking the windows, but for the sneeze, for something that you didn't really do wrong. For the thoughts that accompanied whatever avarice you did, that's what you do when you do tshuva, me'ahava? Well, you're doing tshuva for something that you never did wrong. That does deserve to be compensated for. That does deserve to be compensated for. Because you did tshuva on two things. You did tshuva on your actions, and when you do tshuva, me'ahava, you also did tshuva on the bad thoughts that we had. But you didn't have to do tshuva on those bad thoughts. And therefore, those need still to be compensated. And that's how the Arvei Nachal explains, when we do tshuva me'ahava, not just on the actions that we've done, but on the presence of mind that we had, on the state of mind that we were in, that can be rewarded, that can be transmutated and transformed into mitzvos. To finish off this idea, and to finish off this first half of the shiur tonight, the power of tshuva me'ahava is something that is vast. Much more vast than simply changing averos into not just a shogegim, but even into mitzvos. You see, there's something called the dalet chilukei kapara, the arba chilukei kapara. I had a conversation in my shir this week with a beautiful young man. And he said that since January, he's only eaten kosher. Before January, kashrus is meaningless to him, but since January, he's been keeping only kosher. And he said that in class publicly, and he was very proud of it, and he should be proud of it. It's an incredible thing. So he had his tshuva. He definitely has been keeping to it. He added the commitment. Did he do tshuva? Has he gotten kapara for the non-kosher food that he's eaten in the years prior? Absolutely not. He didn't do tshuva yet. What else is he missing? He had the regret. He has the Kabbalah al Ha'asid. What's the first step of tshuva that he missed? He never did vidui. He has to get up. That's the standard standing vertically. Say, I ate not kosher. Or chatasi, at least. He didn't do that. Therefore, he never did tshuva yet. Okay. So he'll get up, he'll do, say chatasi. And now, magically, he transforms into a genuine Baal tshuva, a true genuine Baal tshuva. I have bad news. It's not so simple. It's really, really, really not so simple. The Gemara in Yuma tells us the following. That there are four different kinds of mitzvos or averos. Four categories. Category number one is a mitzvah asay. If a person doesn't fulfill a mitzvah asay, they eat lunch and they don't bench. Man forgets to put on tefillin in the morning. Whatever other mitzvah asay that a person doesn't fulfill, they don't do kibud av va'em, etc. They don't have Yiras Shamayim, which is a mitzvah saseh daraisa. So you know what a person does? They do tshuva. The second they do tshuva, instant transformation, they're a different person. They're a baal tshuva. That's easy. But then there's another level. What's more severe than not fulfilling a mitzvah saseh? Well, violating a mitzvah lo saseh. Person ate not kosher, person wore shatnez. Here, person ate bugs. Here, the Gemara says, you do tshuva, that doesn't work. You do tshuva, tshuva doesn't work on a mitzvah lo saseh. You have to do tshuva, and then you have to wait. You have to wait until Yom Kippur. The tshuva holds you in abeyance, and then comes Yom Kippur, and Yom Kippur, coupled with the tshuva that you did a day ago, an hour ago, or 11 and a half months ago, will now, the Kedushas Hayom of Yom Kippur, will now cleanse the person from the mitzvahs lo saseh that they violated. It doesn't stop there. That's for a regular lo saseh. But there are levels of severity among averos lo saseh, but among negative commandments. There's a level that's worse than just the lo saseh that gets malkos. There's also averos ikares, or misas beistin, where there are capital punishments that are more severe, like chilul Shabbos, eating on Yom Kippur, doing malacha on Yontif. Those are kares, or beistin takes care of it. There, the Gemara says, you know what? You did tshuva. Full tshuva! Vidui and charata and complete genuine commitments for the future. And Yom Kippur passes! That still doesn't get a person kapara. That doesn't bring atonement for a person for that avera. You know what else you need, a person, God forbid, needs to encounter? Some measure of yisurim. Some iota of some. It's not ours for us to figure out. Hashem figures out whatever is appropriate. Some measure of suffering. And says Rabbeinu Yonah, it's impossible to get full atonement with just the tshuva and Yom Kippur. There needs to be some level of yisurim of suffering. Now, of course, suffering comes in all different shades and packages. The Gemara says, you stick your hand into your pocket to pull out a quarter, and oh my gosh, you pulled out a nickel. That's so annoying. That's yisurim, that's suffering. All of our suffering should be like that. But there has to be something. That's the third level. And then there's a fourth level of person does Chilul Hashem, even Tshuva, and Yom Kippur, and suffering. Still, that's not enough to get full atonement for Chilul Hashem. We won't go into that right now. But, ladies and gentlemen, you know what the Minchas Chinuch and the Chida both say in different ways? That all these levels where we say that Tshuva itself can't work completely to wipe out a mitzvah lo saseh, or a chiyuv kares, or capital punishment, that's only true when a person does their tshuva out of yirah. But if a person does tshuva me'ava, the tshuva me'ava is so deep and so penetrating that the tshuva alone has the capacity to grant absolute kapara, absolute cleanliness, absolute atonement, without Yom Kippur, without yisur, without any suffering, without anything else, just the tshuva alone, because that's the power of tshuva me'ahava. That's the first two-thirds of what I'd like to talk about tonight. Last part of the shir that I'd like to discuss with you is not tshuva per se, not tshuva ahava versus yira, but it's davening. Not davening on a Tuesday in the middle of March, but davening as we do tshuva, because davening is a part of tshuva. If you look at Rabbeinu Yonah in the first shar, he lists off the various parts of a full, complete tshuva. It's more than just the three we mentioned earlier. One of them is doing tefillah. How is tefillah a part? Again, tefillah is great, but how is it a part of the tshuva process itself? The first one's obvious. You have to daven to Hashem that He should forgive you. Right? Just because somebody does tshuva, says they're sorry, if I say, you know, I smack you across the face and I say, I'm sorry, you don't have to say, okay, I forgive you. You could say, nuh-uh, as my children say. And I say, yeah-huh. And they say, nuh-uh. So, you ask for something, you got a nuh-uh. So you have to doubt that Hashem should forgive you when you do tshuva. That's the first thing. The second thing is a little bit deeper. The second reason why a Baal Tshuva needs to daven, says Rabbeinu Yonah, it's for something, a step further. Imagine a terrible situation where there's a husband and a wife. God forbid. The husband cheats on his wife. And afterwards, she finds out, he breaks down, he cries, I'm sorry. And he actually gets out of her mouth the three words, I forgive you. And she doesn't file for divorce, they stay together, and she said, I forgive you. Where are we now? Now everything's better? It's hunky-dory like it was before? It's going to take many, many years of therapy, at best, to maybe or maybe never reach whatever level they were at before this terrible event occurred. That's what we have to daven for. We did something to HaKadosh Baruch Hu Kivyachol, and we did some whatever aver we did, and then, okay, all of a sudden we changed our minds, we're sorry, please, okay, and Hashem says, I forgive you. Great, He forgives us. But where's the relationship? Where's the ratzon that Hashem has towards us? Where's that favor that we have in His eyes? That doesn't have to be there just because He says, forgive you, and He's not going to file for divorce, Kivyachol, and He's not going to punish us for whatever we did. Just because we don't get the punishment, just because we got the forgiveness, that doesn't mean that everything is the way it was, that everything's hunky-dory. That's where tefillah comes in. Because tefillah can take it from not just being a forgiveness, but to also achieving ratzon, achieving that connection, that relationship that we once and we yearn to have once again. Finally, says Rabbeinu Yonah, of course, you know why else we have to daven? We have to daven very simply. So Hashem should help us do tshuva. So we could get forgiven, we could get everything else. If we don't do tshuva, we don't have Hashem's help to do tshuva, nothing happens. But it's not just a matter of davening. It's a matter of knowing how to daven and what to daven for. That's what I'd like to focus on for the remaining few minutes. I want to share with you a story. It's called Everything I Learned from Label the Ganav. It's a Hasidic Shemaisa. Let's assume it's true, because there are real names here. The Holy Rebbe Meir Mipremishlan had a very saintly daughter, Rabbi Tzin Miriam Chaya. And she was known as being a Balas Mofes. People got incredible Yeshuos and Refuos through her Tfilos. And we've heard of Rebbes who, you know, Bali Mofes and great Tzadikim, but it's very unusual that a woman would be the one, you know, to be a Bala small face. The Vision Tzur Rebbe heard about her and traveled when he was passing through Shatz, where she lived, where Meir Premishlan lived. He was from Premishlan. I guess now he lived in Shatz, or his daughter lived in Shatz. Don't worry about that point. And the Vision Tzur Rebbe came and asked to meet her and asked her, how is it, you know, I know your father was a great tzaddik, I'm sure you're a great tzaddikus, and there are many great tzaddikos, but we don't really hear of Bali Mofsim, of, you know, people doing wonders and miraculous things that, you know, just happens. We don't haven't had so many women be like that. And she replied to him, it's really nothing special. It's not a big deal. Everything I got is only because I learned it from Label the Ganav. And she told the Vidus the Rebbe the following. My father, Meir Mipremishlan, was a Rebbe here in this town. And every Motzi Yom Kippur, the Chassidim would line up and shake the Rebbe's hand and get a Shana Tova from him, or probably a Shana Tova from him. And there was a fellow in town, Label the Ganav, and he desperately wanted to get a bracha like the rest of the Hasidim in town because, I'd say business wasn't so great. He wanted a bracha like everybody else, but he knew that he wouldn't be able to stand in line because the Rebbe would scream at him, how would the Rebbe give him a bracha if he's a Ganav? You should have success in your Parnasa, and the Rebbe would never say that. So he stood on the side, in a surreptitious kind of way, waiting for like that moment when maybe the Rebbe would be distracted and he could slip in and grab the Rebbe's hand, the Rebbe would just mutter Shana Tova to him and he would quickly move out of the way. And that's exactly what he did, that's exactly what happened. He slipped in, the Rebbe looked somewhere else, he grabbed the Rebbe's hand. The Rebbe was an observant, not in the, you know what I mean, caught on very quickly what's happening and started screaming at him. It's bad enough that you're stealing from the people of our town, but you want to steal a bracha from me as well? The Rebbe asked him, and listen to what he answered to the Rebbe. He said, no, Rebbe, chas v'shalom. Absolutely not. I would never ask for a bracha from the Rebbe to help me steal from somebody who doesn't deserve to be stolen from. The bracha that I'm asking is that if there's a gzeira min hashamayim, that somebody should suffer a theft, God forbid, let at least me be the one to be the recipient of that. Asked Leibler to the Rebbe. Remeir and Premishlan was so impressed, was so enchanted by that creative request. He said, I'll give you a bracha, a good kibbutz diyar, shana taifa. His daughter was in the back of the room. She ran over to her father, and she said, if you could give that bracha to a ganav, then I'm going to ask you that if there's ever a Jew who's going through a hard time and has a trouble and is going through, they're sick or whatever else is their problem, and they're going to have Yeshua, they're going to have refuah, please let me be the one, let me be the tool through whom and through which that Yeshua comes. So you see, Vishnu Tzareba, she said, it's nothing special. I don't have any special powers. I can't do anything. It's going to happen anyway. I'm just the tool that it comes, the aqueduct via which the Yeshua comes. I'm not doing anything. We could ask for so much from Hashem. It's really a question of what we daven for. I'd like to outline three very specific steps to enhance our tefillah over the next day or two, the Yom HaKadosh that we'll soon be standing in, and to take with ourselves in general. Similar story, but different, to this Maisa Motzei Yom Kippur in the Ir Shatz, was with my Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel of the Mir Yeshiva in Yerushalayim. Those have heard of him or have seen him. He had a very severe case of, I don't remember if it was Lou Gehrig's disease or Parkinson's, and he shook and he wasn't able to move his body so well, but his mind was sharp as a needle. And if you go to Mizvah the Mir, you'll notice that there's a ramp that goes around the building on the outside. They built it specially for him that he could walk up and then later be wheeled up straight to his seat in the front of the Beis Medrash. There's a door that they broke through the back of the building for. Well, the minhag in the Mir is that after a Motzei Yom Kippur, everybody lines up and wishes the Rosh Yeshiva a good kibbutz diyar, shana tova. There's a fellow named Shlomo Gross from Flatbush, very wealthy businessman, gigantic Baal Tzedakah, and he was in the Mir. He came to Eretz Yisrael for Yom Kippur, maybe he was going to stay for Sukkos, and he went to daven. After the davening, he stood online, and of course, Nosson Tzvi Finkel knew him as a big Baal Tzedakah. And there's a picture, actually, I printed the picture, but for whatever reason, the printer didn't, my Google Docs, whatever, it didn't print the picture. I was going to show you the picture of Reb Shlomo Gross from Flatbush getting a bracha from Reb Nosson Tzvi Finkel 3 years ago on Motzei Yom Kippur. Neither of them knew at that time that neither of them would make it to the next Yom Kippur. Reb Nosson Tzvi Finkel was nifter. His son became the next Rosh Yeshiva. And Shlomo Gross passed away at the age 50, and his youngest son was 11 years old. So at that Motzei Yom Kippur, along the line, Shlomo Gross asked Reb Nosson Tzvi Finkel, what should I daven for? What should I daven for this year? It's a very appropriate question. Let me just tell you who Shlomo Gross is. I found this story about Shlomo Gross, that his son, Aaron Gross, was baking matzahs in the following. Shlomo Gross died in March, about two or three years ago. And just 2 months later, his son Aaron was baking matzahs somewhere in Williamsburg, and he went to daven Vasikin and said Kaddish. Somebody in the shtiebel in Williamsburg saw he was saying Kaddish and saw his talis bake, said Gross. He said, oh, are you the son of Shlomo Gross? I said, yeah, I am. He said, let me tell you a story about your father. I never met you. I met your father once. I'm sure he doesn't really know me, but I want to share with you a story because maybe you could learn something about your father. I have a friend, said this Hasidic Yid in Williamsburg, who has an organization in Mea Shearim or in Beis Yisrael, like a Tomchei Shabbos. They have a $2 million budget, and they distribute food before Yom Tov. And I noticed that there was a truck parked where my friend's organization is parked, and unloading 50-pound bags, or whatever, 20-kilo bags from the back of the truck was this, like, youngish, middle-aged, very American, you know, like, nice, fancy pants and, like, a white starched shirt, very American, flappishy-looking kind of guy who was lugging the heavy sacks of potatoes off the back of the truck and, you know, putting them, you know, wherever they had to go in the pile to be distributed. And I went over to my friend, says the Chassid Shayid, who's the head of this organization. I asked him, you know, what kind of workers are you hiring for your food distribution? So the guy who's the head of this organization laughs. He says, no, he's not one of the workers. This is Rav Shlomo Gross, the famous Baal Tzedaka from Flatbush, one of the biggest Baal Tzedaka in New York. And so the Chassid Shayid continues telling the son at the shtibel, so I approached your father, and I went over to him, and I said, excuse me for asking, but why are you doing this? So your father told me, because I love doing this. And then he says, and besides, what kind of question is that? What do you mean, why am I doing this? Of course, like, I don't even understand what you're asking me. So the Yid told the son, that was the story of your father. And then he continued, said the story didn't stop there. A few days later, before your father left Israel, you don't know this, but apparently that truck that he was unloading was an old, broken-down delivery truck. And he was worried that maybe the organization would be left without a truck that worked. So before he left that $50,000 check to buy themselves a new truck so they don't have to be worried about transportation problems for the organization. That was Shlomo Gross. So Shlomo Gross is standing there online in front of Nassim Tzvi Finkel 3 years ago, and he asked the Rosh Yeshiva, what should I daven for? Now, he wasn't the first person to ask that question to Nassim Tzvi Finkel. I did. When I was in the mirror, I asked him two questions. Maybe more, but two questions that stand out in my mind. And I want you to understand who Nassim Tzvi Finkel is so you could appreciate these questions, his answers better yet. There's a period of three or four Friday nights that I got terrible headaches on Friday night. Vidavka Friday night. Really bad headaches. After three or four Friday nights of this happening, I go to the Rosh Hashiva and I say, Rosh Hashiva, you have to understand, I was really flipped out at that time. I was like, you know, assuming, waiting for some deep Kabbalistic, my Kavanos and Bima Kabbal Shabbos are probably not where they should be, and my Neshama and Shabbos or something or other, some very deep thing, and I said, I'm getting headaches always the same time. It's always Friday night at like 8 or 9 o'clock. The Shiva looked at me and said, Uri, you have to get more sleep. That was the first question I asked him. Second question I asked him, a different time. Again, I was in a similar state of mind, and I was working on my davening, my tefillah, my avoda, and I was working on Shema. And I said, Rosh Hashiva, what kavanah should I have when I say Shema Yisrael? And I was waiting here for him to tell me the Chachma Sanista, whatever the Kabbalistic things that a person, Kavanos should have, a person should have when they recite Shema. So he looked at me in the eyes and said, Uri, you should think about what the words mean. Okay? So, anyway, Shlomo Gross, I told you who he is, and now you understand Rav Nathan Tzvi a little bit. He asked Rav Nathan Tzvi, what should I daven for? So what do you tell Shlomo Gross? Another $10 million to give to Tzedakah? What should he daven for? Rav Nathan Tzvi said, Rav Shlomo, for somebody else. You should daven for somebody else. That's what Rav Nathan Tzvi told Rav Shlomo Gross. You want to know what to daven for? You should daven for somebody else. In a certain sense, I'm a little bit luckier than a lot of you, because I don't just have my own problems, my children's problems, but because I'm a rabbi of a shul, I get to hear other people's problems also. There are a lot of problems. Klal Yisrael has a lot of problems. A lot of people in this room, going through very hard times. If at any point on Yom Kippur, you're not able to muster a little bit of kavanah, you're not able to think about what you're saying, I have very good advice for you. I have very good advice. If you can't daven for yourself, you're drained, there's nothing left in the reservoir, your arms are hurting and your neck, back is broken and your knees are buckling, daven for somebody else. That's the first point. Especially, the Gemara Bava Kama tells us, Kol HaMevakesh Rachamim Al Chaveiro V'hu Tzarech Lo'osa Davar. If a person davens for their friend and they need that same thing, Hu Na'anet Chila. The person who davens, they're davening for their friend, but they need it, they'll get answered first if they're davening for somebody else, as opposed to if they're davening for themselves. The second message about how to daven is another a little bit of a Hasidic story. Only out of true drasha could I get away with saying two Hasidic stories, but this is about the Belzer Rebbe. The Belzer Rebbe had a gathering on the area of Yom Kippur, and his maybe on Yom Kippur, and all the Hasidim were there to have an audience with the Rebbe, and one of his Hasidim finds out that his shtreimel was stolen. And shtreimels are not like black hats. Black hats you can buy for $100, $200. Shtreimels cost a good $1,000, $2,000. A beaver had to give up his life for a shtreimel. So the Rebbe says, the fellow comes to the Rebbe and says, Rebbe, it's hard to imagine, but somebody here stole my shtreimel. The Rebbe says, I know who it is. I want you to go to a train station right now, look for a fellow with a brown coat on the bottom left, the left pocket of his brown coat has a little tear. I want you to find him in the train station. He should be there about now. He's the one who stole your shtreimel. Oh boy, okay, that's pretty good. And goes to the train station, looks around, it's pretty quiet, and he finds a fellow in a brown coat, pocket on the left side, a little tear on the bottom, confronts the man, lo and behold, opens up the man's suitcase, and there's the stolen shtreimel. He's a believer. Oh my goodness. He runs back to the Rebbe and says, Rebbe, how do you know? How do you get this nevuah to know? The Rebbe said, very simply. Because I've been here for 3 days. Everybody's coming to ask me for brachas. And there was one fellow who asked me for one bracha. He didn't ask me for hatzlach in learning. He didn't ask me for hatzlach in davening. He asked me for hatzlach in business. And that's all. If there's somebody that all they care about is hatzlach in business, obviously, that's going to be the person who stole your shtreimel. Lesson number two is that when we daven, we should daven not just for what we need in the gashmias plane, but also for what we need spiritually. Sefer Hasidim writes that you know why? Not just you know why. You know what? When we daven for spiritual things, Hashem will always answer our tefillas. If we daven for something spiritual, if we daven with all of our heart, you know why? Rasul Salanter says the reason why is because if you're in the army, who's the one who has to give you the bullets? Do you have to provide your own bullets? Do you have to provide your own gun? Do you have to provide your own food if you're in the army? Of course not. Who has to do that? The king or the government or whoever's army you're in. If you're asking for tools to protect, to do your mission as a soldier in Hashem's army, who has to provide you the tools for that? Who has to provide you the tools? Who has to give you the health and the money that you need not to go on vacation in Bermuda, and there's nothing wrong with that if you have the right kavanos, but who gives you the energy and the tools to be able to serve Hashem with a calmness, with a focus? Hashem has to provide it if you're working for Him. The final point that I'd like to make in terms of davening is much deeper. It's much deeper, and it's not really for us. It's a little bit beyond where we are. But sometimes it's important to hear things that are above where we are so that we have something to strive for and something to sort of reach for, to feel inspired by. That's the following. I'll start backwards. From whom in Tanakh do we learn all of Hilchos Tefillah? From Chana. We learn that you're supposed to daven Shmona Esrei with your mouth, moving your mouth, you should hear it, other people don't have to. All the halachas of davening we learn from Chana, when she davened to have children. And if you look at that pasuk, it doesn't say that she davened to Hashem. It says something weird. Vatispalel, not El Hashem, Al Hashem. She davened for Hashem. V'chaim V'lazhar, Nefesh HaChaim, and Shar Beis explains what was happening. Why is Chana the paradigm of what a perfect tefillah is? Because she wasn't davening to Hashem, she was davening for Hashem. She wasn't saying, Hashem, I feel so terrible, I'm going through such a hard time, please help me because of my pain that I'm suffering and that I'm encountering. That was not her tefillah. Her tefillah was, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because of the pain that I'm suffering, the pain that I'm going through, kivyachol, you are going through this terrible pain along with the Jewish people who are suffering. And therefore I'm davening for you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to not have to have that Sar HaShechina. Chazal teaches that whenever a Jew goes through whatever painful experience they have, a Jew has a headache, says the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as if it were, cries out, Kalni Meiroshi, Oyve, my head hurts, Oyve, my arm hurts, says the Mishnah in Sanhedrin. Whenever a Jew is suffering anything at all, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I won't say that I understand what this means, is going through some similar pain as if it were. When we daven, forget about ourselves. Don't daven for ourselves, even for spiritual things. Daven only. Again, that's a very, very high level. And that's what we're saying daven. And every day during Aseret Yemei Teshuva and Shmona Esrei, Zachreinu L'chaim L'chafetz B'chaim V'kosveinu B'sefer HaChaim. Why? Why should you write us in the Book of Chaim? L'ma'ancha Elokim Chaim, for your sake. So you should have a Kvod Shemayah. So you should not be B'tzar. Not for me. Do it for your sake, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the third point of tefillah. Perhaps that we could grow it and focus on. I want to end with one idea, halacha l'maisa. I think it's very, very, very halacha l'maisa. It's very, very, very practical. We're going to recite Vidui a lot of times. Every tefillah of Shmona Esrei, a second time during Chazor Sashatz, and even Mincha Erev Yom Kippur. There are five tefillahs on Yom Kippur. There's Mariv, there's Shacharis, there's Musaf, there's Mincha, there's Ne'ilah. 5 times 2 plus 2 on Erev Yom Kippur. That's 12 times we're going to say Vidui. I want to give you a tool. I found it helpful. I've used it before. It takes a little bit of energy, but I think it's a very useful tool. I mentioned 45 minutes ago, 55 minutes ago, that the Rambam does not count a mitzvah to do tshuva. He says the mitzvah chayav lihisvados, to confess, to do tshuva, to do vidui, to recite vidui. That's the mitzvah d'oraisa, to recite vidui. And then he adds two words. Lifnei Hashem. Does it say anywhere that you have to eat matzah lifnei Hashem? Does it say anywhere that you have to blow shofar lifnei Hashem? Does it say you have to do Shabbos or whatever else, Lifnei Hashem? Why Vidu do you have to do Lifnei Hashem? I don't know why, but I know what. It's incredibly helpful. I've found from my own personal experiences that before we do Vidui, picture for a moment that we're not just talking to our sitter, not even are we talking to ourselves. Picture yourself peering eye to eye, as if it were, peering into HaKadosh Baruch Hu's eyes, kivyachol. And Him looking straight back at you, kivyachol. Picture yourself lifnei Hashem. And then, when you picture yourself lifnei Hashem, say chatasi, say hashamnu. It's a very different chatasi. It's a very different chatasi. It's a very different hashamnu. Because you don't just do something. There's a very direct connection. You realize that what I did was lifnei Hashem, the chet that I did lifnei Hashem, and now I'm coming back to do my vidui lifnei Hashem. Finally, of course, I have to say this, as I say every year, the ikar thing that we come out with from Yom Kippur and on Yom Kippur are the decisive, determined decisions that we commit to. And like we say every year, the decisions that we make, the commitments that we make have to be tiny commitments. They have to be for a very short amount of time. Rav Shach's famous Kabbalah on Yom Kippur that he's going to bench from inside a bencher until Hanukkah or something like that. If you're Rav Shach, you could take something on till Hanukkah. If you're not Rav Shach, it shouldn't be that long either. Something really tiny. Whatever you think you could commit to, cut it in half, then slice it in half again. And as long as you think you could hold on to it, cut that in half and cut that in half again. Commit to something for a week, for 2 weeks. Those are the commitments. Those are the real, genuine changes that we can make in our lives practically. Not idealistically, but realistically. And be different people after Yom Kippur. And to finish, there's a mitzvah to eat. Midaraisa on Friday. Every Yom Kippur there's a mitzvah to eat. And the reason why there's a mitzvah to eat is relatively obvious, Rabbeinu Yonah writes. Because you're going to have to fast the next day. That's one reason. And there's another reason, because every Yontif has to have a Sudas Yontif. And obviously you can't have a Sudas Yontif on Yom Kippur. So you have it the day before Yom Kippur. But he says there's another reason why we have to eat on Yom Kippur. And it goes back to that story I told you about that beautiful student who's been keeping kosher since January. And we pointed out that even though he's been keeping kosher since January, and he'll get up and he'll say his vidui, but he's not going to get his kapara until Yom Kippur comes. And you know what it's like? Imagine, I don't know if any of you have any cousins who are in the army. I have a nephew or two who's in the army in Eretz Yisrael. And right before you get your Golan or your Tzanchanim, your beret, you have to go on the Masak Kumta. This is like 100 kilometers with 70, I don't remember if they're pounds or kilo on your back, running through the night straight for who knows how long. And you're running and you're chugging along with this, your backpack and your water things and your ammunition. And then, of course, you also have to carry the stretcher with the fattest guy in the brigade lying on it and laughing as you struggle to carry him. And you're plotting and you're sweating and the straps of your pack are ripping into your shoulders and your ammunition belt is just cutting into your flanks. You haven't slept in forever. And then the pakid says, Rabotai! You see that hilltop over there? You get there? You get your green beret. You get your red beret. That's where we are right now. We're carrying this heavy load of guk on our shoulders. We've been running with it and carrying it, and it's been tearing into our shoulders and cutting into our flanks and making us feel miserable. And we've been carrying it and bearing it for so long and so uncomfortable. And Rabotai, in a few hours, just 46 hours or so from now, you're going to take all those packs, throw your knapsack on the floor, unbuckle that ammunition belt, let your canteen drop on the floor, and everything will just get washed away with the tshuva that we do. If we do tshuva, with the tshuva that we do. Yes, we have to do tshuva. But with the tshuva that we do, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to wash everything away. And that's why we celebrate, says Rabbeinu Yonah, on the day before Yom HaKippurim. Because the more we acknowledge how excited we are to get to that finish line, you know what that shows? What does it show when you're excited to get to the finish line? That you're not excited to not be at the finish line. The more excited you are when you're about to throw off your pack shows how heavy that pack is on your back and how much it's cutting into your sides. And that's the reason, says Rabbeinu Yonah, why we have a mitzvah to fast on, a mitzvah to eat on Erev Yom Kippur. Because the more we celebrate and are excited about the coming of Yom Kippur and the kapra that we're going to receive, the more we indicate the pain that we have and the dissatisfaction that we have with what we have now. Be'ezras Hashem, Kadosh Baruch Hu will see the excitement that we have over the next few days, over the prospect of throwing down all that guk and all that garbage, becoming free again. Kadosh Baruch Hu will accept our tefillos that we daven for others. Kadosh Baruch Hu will accept the tefillos that we daven for our ruchnias. Kadosh Baruch Hu will hopefully accept the tefillos that we daven for Kvod Shemayim, for the Geula, for the Malchus Shemayim to become recognized. Kadosh Baruch Hu will see the Tshuva Me'ava that we do and the power that with the Teshuvah Me'ava that we won't have to even wait for anything else, for Yom Kippur, for Safrei Chas V'Shalom. Hashem will take all of that. He'll accept the viduis that we are misvad in front of Him. He'll accept the Kabbalahs that we commit to with our determination to commit. As Hashem will grant us, you, your families, Klal Yisrael, Shas Chaim V'Shalom, a year that Yimali Hashem Kol, Mishaloseinu L'Tova, all of our tefillos should be answered in the best possible way. Your Simcha, your Simachos for each and every one of us, year of Yeshuos for all the challenges that we have as individuals, for the challenges that Klal Yisrael has, for each and every one of you and of us. Shavu Gmarach Simatova, Shnas Chaim V'Shalom. Thank you all so much for coming and for joining us and for coming to do B'mahar HaTshuva B'yachad and the Koach of the Kahal, the Koach of coming together as a Tzibur. We'll hopefully take that Hirhur Tshuva into a Tshuva Me'ava. Gmarach Simatova.